Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or any of its affiliates. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to take them at the end of the call. Please email them to David_Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at HancockBank.com. And today on the call, we have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer for Hancock & Whitney Bank, and we have David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, Greg Haliski, Jeff Tangus, all our investment directors for Hancock & Whitney Bank. With that, Dave, I'm going to go ahead and pass it on to you.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. And, John, we'll start with you. I guess, you know, fortunately, March was not a overly exciting month. And, you know, there's really no apparent change in the economic numbers as of late. Things still look pretty good. Manufacturing in March expanded at a fast rate driven by gains in employment and production. A couple questions. Where do you expect first quarter GDP to be? And what are the leading indicators telling us about the next few months and even the rest of the year, if that's possible to predict?
Okay. First of all, when we think about GDP and the guesses that we all make and the guesses that we hear in the news media, we have to understand that they are really guesses. And even when you're right in the middle of a quarter or near the end of a quarter, as we are, sometimes people can be pretty far off in terms of their estimates. But there seems to be a clustering of estimates now that the first quarter will be, say, 2.5%, I guess, as a baseline estimate. Last year, the average growth for the entire year was about, 1.9%, something less than 2. And the fourth quarter was 3. Nobody expected the first quarter of this year to be particularly strong. One thing that continues to be, an indicator that while we are in an expansion and the leading indicators, indicate that a recession is imminent at this point. Real disposable income is not growing well. Consumption is relatively weak compared to where it should be at this point in a normal cycle. Company investment is nothing to write home about either, and neither is revenue growth. So, bottom line is it looks like we're probably still in, what the PIMCO boys would describe as a new normal situation where trend line growth is for the economy in terms of real GDP is closer to 2% than 3%. And I guess that's likely to continue for a while there. It looks like recession is not a near-term possibility, but at the same time, it looks like, any growth we get is going to be relatively moderate.
Okay, thanks, John. Let's talk a little bit about the Eurozone. I know that's been a topic on many of our calls, and, I think the markets, to a certain extent, have put the Eurozone situation behind us, almost as if everything is fine. And I guess I'm concerned, and I know you have similar concerns, that market participants have become very complacent in regards to the situation. Do you agree with the perception that people feel that it's no longer a risk? Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the markets are probably acting as if, the risk has dissipated to a degree, and perhaps that's true. I guess there was a concern a few months back that, if the Europeans didn't do something fairly drastic, that, there was a possibility that Greece would, default completely in a messy way and leave the euro, and others might fall into, the same situation thereafter. So the Europeans threw a lot of money at the problem. But when you look at the circularity of where all this money went, it came out of the ECB, went to the banks, and then, back to some of the sovereign bonds and back to the ECB. So, nobody is really sure whether, anything much was done to improve the situation. Recently, Hughes report suggests that they probably need to come up with about $1 trillion to really put a firewall, or €1 trillion, I guess, to put a firewall around some of these companies, countries. And I'm not sure anybody knows really exactly how that's going to work out. So the problem is still there. You know, the more research we see on countries like Spain, for example, which is, would be a fairly large problem if they got in serious difficulty, you know, is that, for example, if all of the banks in Spain were forced to write their mortgages down to real value, every bank in Spain would probably be bankrupt. So, you know, the Spanish situation is a little different. It's not so much the government as it is private debt in Spain. But in any case, while sovereign bond yields are lower, they're still really too high for the countries to handle to, really grow their way out of the problem. So Portugal is probably going to be another country like Greece that's going to have either a lot of aid or perhaps go into some sort of bankruptcy or repudiation of bonds to some degree. And recently, there had been concerns about France. France has an election coming up. Sarkozy, and of course we have to look at all the French, I guess, as being somewhat more socialistic, I guess, than we are. But apparently this Holland, or I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, Holland, the guy who's in competition with Sarkozy for president of France, he's very left-wing and has, as the Economist would say, some barmy ideas. And according to a recent issue of The Economist, the analysts were of the opinion that even if Sarkozy manages to win, he'll have some barmy ideas of his own to put out there. And people are becoming somewhat concerned about France's situation as well, because their debt-to-GDP ratio is beginning to... Everybody still there, Dave?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. It is beginning to deteriorate a little bit. So I guess at best, we've got a situation where, you know, various forms of austerity, depression, and recession will exist in the Eurozone for quite some time, which will certainly put a lid on growth there. And I guess for a time until, you know, something really significantly changes, we're going to be faced with the possibility that individual elections and social disruptions in some of these countries, you know, could produce a crisis atmosphere at almost any time. And so I guess that's something that's always going to be out there and something that we're always going to have to be aware of. The other thing, of course, is that to the extent that all of these difficulties in Europe hold down growth and keep some of those countries in recession, it means that our exports to Europe are going to suffer. And, of course, in an interconnected world that we live in, it means that we can't escape some fallout from that. Plus the fact everybody knows China is slowing a bit, and that's going to take a little bit out of world GDP growth too. So it looks like overall, you know, we're still in, you know, at best, a relatively low growth world with some, you know, pockets here and there that look a little bit more attractive, but nevertheless, that's something is probably going to be with us for some time.
John, a lot of the European nations are facing a combination of tax increases and spending cuts, and we have the same problem upon us here in the U.S. And former Fed Reserve Vice Chairman Alan Blinder, came out with some comments recently. And he talked about the United States cruising toward a 2013 fiscal cliff, and that was a new term to me. I haven't heard fiscal cliff before, but it's basically that, a combination of tax increases and spending cuts. And I was hoping maybe we could talk a little bit about the tax increase side. And if the House and Senate don't act over the course of the remainder of 2012, then the Bush tax cuts will expire. The temporary payroll tax cut will end, and unemployment benefits will be severely curtailed, all on January 1st, 2013. And I guess the scary part about this is that it requires some type of action by Congress to prevent all of these from expiring. Should the markets be concerned about this yet?
Probably the markets are going to start getting concerned about it in the months to come. There is a feeling that something will be done or can be done after the elections to perhaps in the early part of 2013, do something to prevent this fiscal, cliff from arriving. And I think to some degree probably the markets are factoring in the idea that something will be done to perhaps not make that such a significant situation. But in terms of dollars, the last estimate I saw on that indicated it would be about a $500 billion hit to the economy. And particularly from our standpoint, it would mean a lot for dividend taxes, for example, and capital gains. But dividend tax, for example, would go back to ordinary rates that were in effect under, the Bush tax cuts, which would be 39.5%. In New York State, I believe the effective marginal rate, the highest marginal rate, would approach 44% when you include state taxes. So it would be a pretty significant hit to dividends and certainly have some impact on the market. So that is certainly a big unknown. And it's probably, depending on how the political game is played between now and the end of the year, going to, become even more important as we get toward that point. But I think at this point, it hasn't been really reflected in market prices. I think everybody thinks that maybe something will, be done or some movement toward some sort of solution will occur prior to the end of the year to take this particular problem off the table. But certainly, the closer we get to the end of the year and the more this piece of uncertainty hangs out there, the worse it's going to be for economic decision makers generally. One thing I might mention here, too, about regulatory uncertainty. Several years ago when, we were approaching the bottom of the bear market and beginning to enter the, expansion or the recovery from the recession, our theme was cyclical recovery with secular headwinds. And the tax situation is one of those secular headwinds, i.e., how do you pay for, all of the unfunded liabilities that we have ahead of us if we don't raise some taxes? And, what do you do about the Bush tax cuts when they expire? Some professors have started making some studies on regulatory uncertainties and created a regulatory index a few years ago that they are eventually going to take back to the post-World War II period, I believe, back as close to World War II as they can get it. But anyway, to make a long story short, as you might imagine, their regulatory uncertainty index is higher than it's ever been and has really taken a big jump in the last few years, and it's still up there. So, to the extent we have any kind of regulatory uncertainty out there, it's going to be a negative, or certainly will throw a wet blanket on some of the prospects going forward. By the way, I saw a figure recently on Social Security's unfunded liability, and you see a lot of numbers thrown around out there in the media, and you don't know which ones are correct. This one apparently came from the Congressional Budget Office. It's $17 trillion Social Security unfunded liability, which means obviously that either we're all going to be paying a hell of a lot more for Social Security taxes, or it means that the situation, the program will be adjusted and retirement age will be extended. So that's probably something that will not happen because it really can't happen. But in any case, a lot of these things, in addition to taxes, are hanging out there that produce enough uncertainty to probably dampen the animal spirits that exist currently. So again, everything can, going back, I guess, in a circular fashion, contributing to that idea that any economic progress we make for a number of years is probably going to be relatively modest.
I guess if you couple that with the elections at the end of the year, we'll have a lot to talk about in that fourth quarter, so it should be interesting. Greg, despite all that, the markets continue to plow forward. It was another good month for stocks. The S&P 500 for March was up 3.3%, and that pulled the year-to-date, or the first quarter number for 2012, up to 12.6%. We're at, the S&P 500 is at levels that we haven't seen in almost 4 years. We've had a nice run. What are your thoughts, Greg?
Yeah, it's, you know, take a little broader even perspective. If you look at the Dow was up 8.8%, NASDAQ was up actually 19%. And the NASDAQ, as some of you may know, tends to have a lot smaller stocks and is kind of technology-weighted, which actually was one of the better-performing sectors for the quarter. As you pointed out, the S&P 500 was up 12.6%. The S&P 600 trailed just slightly at about 11.3, and the Russell 2000 was up 12.4. When you see numbers like that, and I guess just trying to put things in perspective, if we look back in 2010, the S&P 500 was up about 5.4% in the first quarter, and in 2011 it was up 5.9%. Now, I think in the past we've kind of talked about the pattern that we saw in 2010 and 2011, and what was always derailing us in the past 2 years was the European situation. Hopefully, Europe has gotten its act together enough where perhaps the pattern breaks in 2012. In any event, I think it wouldn't be unusual for the market to pull back here, and I don't think necessarily that I'm talking about a correction at this point, but when you do run up in this fast, this far in the beginning of the year, it's really hard to expect that the market can continue this type of momentum right now. So in the end, I think things are still relatively positive. If you look at valuations right now, the 12-month forward PE is at about 12.9 times earnings versus the long-term mean at 14.6. So I wouldn't necessarily say that this would trigger us to get more defensive, but again, I think it's beneficial to probably let clients know that with this kind of a strong run, that for the market to pull back some and take a breather is not out of the ordinary. Just looking at the earnings front, we're starting to see earnings per share estimates finally come down. We've had 9 quarters of double-digit gains, and there's a lot of speculation on whether Q1 of 2012 would change that, and it did. Right now, it looks like we're actually going to be down about a negative 0.1%. But that's okay. It doesn't necessarily mean that earnings are falling through the floor. It just means that they're finally moderating, and as John pointed out, as global growth and GDP moderate with China slowing down, and I believe actually Europe is the biggest exporter to China, but obviously our exports to Europe would suffer. So you would expect to see some kind of a drop in revenue. Plus, margins tend to be a bit extended also. So the down move, I think, just, again, reflects the economic growth at this point in time. But on a more optimistic note, although we're probably looking at maybe single-digit earnings growth for the balance of 2012, analysts, at least at this point, are looking at the fourth quarter of 12 and the first quarter of 2013, where they're looking at double-digit earnings growth again, looking at, perhaps 16% in the fourth quarter of this year and 14% in the first quarter of 2013. So still think there's some positives out there, and, I think we're just going to, again, just see a little bit of a slowdown, but hopefully, there's nothing on the horizon, at least from our perspective, that would require us, would want us to get, much more defensive at this point.
Excellent. Thank you. Do I say something?
No.
Okay. Luther, talk a little bit about the Fed. They're official statement from the Fed in March was pretty vanilla, nothing exciting there, but other Fed communications have caused a bit of a stir. They've been very active in speaking, and there's been plenty of Fed speak, all of the Fed terminology on the wire as of late. Fiscal cliff, which we talked a little bit about earlier, QE3, sterilized QE, Operation Twist, renewed inflation talk. What does it all mean, and what is the Fed thinking right now?
I think what it all means is that the Fed is as uncertain, or confused is probably not the right word, but uncertain as to which way the economy is heading. Actually, today, the minutes of the last meeting will be released, but the statements for the last meeting on March 13 I'm going to read you a couple of them to kind of give you an idea of what the Fed is thinking. And the first is that the downside risks to growth continue to outweigh the upside risks to inflation, which, you know, that's pretty clear for the Fed to say that there's just we're just not quite sure whether we have sufficient economic momentum. And another statement was, while manufacturing activity continues to expand at an increasingly slower pace, service activity, the largest part of the economy, appears to be gaining momentum. But another sentence was added saying that the momentum is uneven and modest. So we've got some bright spots in the economy, but we don't have enough momentum yet for the Fed to say declare victory in its war on or trying to stimulate the economy without creating too much inflation. I think a lot of what's been going on with a lot of the other commentary is, I mean, to a certain extent, some of it could be intentional. But it's not unusual for certain Fed members, particularly, to make comments that are not exactly what the Fed is putting in its statements. I think it's a good thing because it gives us an indication that the Fed is not complacent with where we are, that there are some Fed members who believe that maybe the economy is stronger than everyone else thinks, but that overall they're going to do anything and everything they can to make sure the economy picks up additional speed and to the extent possible make sure that inflation doesn't go above and beyond their targeted rate, which is about, I guess, 2 to 2.5%. So they're still in the same case as what everybody else here has said, is that, you know, things are looking better, but, you know, we have this cliff coming up. We have a lot of uncertainty still in other places. And we're just going to have to wait and see how Europe comes out, how the regulatory environment changes, at some point in the future, maybe we'll be able to say with some certainty that things are getting better. There are some really good economic numbers out there that indicate things could get better. Household financial obligations are down to a 28-year low in the fourth quarter of this year, which after reaching a high in the third quarter of 2007. The problem with that is that the consumer has the same problem the Fed does. There's a lot of concern about the regulatory environment, about inflation, about everything else. We're on the fence, and I think we're leaning to where the economy will pick up and things will get better, but it would be very easy for us to fall off the fence and go back into a much slower growth environment, while maybe probably not a recessionary environment.
Okay, thank you, Luther. Jeff, talk about the bond market a bit. Yields across the curve have backed up in the month of March, not tremendously, but we've seen some rise in rates. The 10-year Treasury is about 2.2%, which I guess is that around 20 basis points up maybe over the course of the month?
That's about right, yeah.
So I guess the question is this the beginning of a bond bear market or this just normal trading range?
Well, that's the question we're getting a lot these days because rates are so low, everybody is hypersensitive about a big move up in rates. But the reality is, for all the reasons everyone else on this call has talked about, the economy is just not strong enough to warrant dramatically higher interest rates. The Fed would not tolerate dramatically higher interest rates. So there's nothing to indicate that this is the start of a bear move higher in interest rates. The reality is we've really just been in a very tight trading range ever since the Greek situation last fall became such a great concern and was threatening to drag Europe down. All we've done really since the Greek situation has been, or I should say not resolved, but the can has been kicked farther down the road than we've been able to kick it in a while. People have sort of returned to focusing more so back on our economy and on our economic news. So we really are just going back to where we were in the summer of last year. I think the 10-year topped out about a little under 2.4%, and we've actually come down since then. I think cooler heads have prevailed, and people have realized because of the soft economy here in the U.S. and abroad, that we're not likely to see much higher interest rates. So, so that in a nutshell, that's kind of where we are. But also, just as important as what those longer-term rates have done is really what the very short-term interest rates have done. I think that's also a pretty good indication of the fact that people have moved on from the Greek debt crisis. Short-term interest rates, T-bills specifically, were really flirting with zero and at times even negative yields as people, primarily Europeans who were concerned about the European banks, put money in our short-term T-bills and would actually accept the negative yield. That's no longer the case, and again, an indication that the Greek situation is fading from most people's concerns these days. There's a little bit of a little bit of a signal that sometime latter part of this year or the first part of next year, the Fed might start talking about raising short-term interest rates, or at least indicating that it might be on the horizon. So there's a little bit of an indication there. The yield curve's a little steeper. A couple things that indicate that we're not where we were a year or two ago economically. Certainly the economy's better, but still fairly weak. So once you once you get outside of the Treasury market in the corporate bond world, rates rose, but not quite as much as Treasuries. So they're still very attractive, however, on a relative value basis. And municipal rates rose, but even less so than corporate securities. So it was really the Treasury market that reacted, again, because of the Greek situation. I'd say looking forward, we don't expect a whole lot. We expect a trading range, I guess, would be the best way to put it. The trading range to kind of go back to where it was the latter part of last year, with the top of the range being somewhere 240, 2.5%, something of that nature, not dramatically higher than where we are now. And the things that could be the fly in the ointment there, if Spain or Portugal, one of the European countries, got into a financial crisis, then you'd probably see a replay of the Greek situation again. So notwithstanding that kind of a scenario, it's likely that there might be a modest bias upward in rates, but for the most part, just a trading range where we've been.
Thank you, Jeff. If anybody has any questions, please email them to me, David_Lundgren@HancockBank.com. And we have received one question so far, and I think it's probably more related to the stock market. I'm going to throw it to John and Greg if you guys want to take this one. Question is, it's actually a couple questions. What are you doing to position the portfolios at this time? The markets have run up substantially. Are you taking some of the chips off the table? Are you rotating to other sectors?
I'll address that, Dave. This is Greg. I think the key point probably to take away here with regard to how we're positioning portfolios is, one, our models, which, you know, we run monthly, are really designed to seek out relative value across sectors. So really, as the market complexion changes, and that can be, you know, whether the market's declining or it's increasing, throughout our rebalancing process and the funds and individual accounts, the portfolios are really automatically positioned to take advantage of better opportunities across the sectors. So, you know, if the models are seeing better value in consumer discretionary, it's going to move the portfolios in that direction. If a model sees that technology is better valued relative to the other sectors, it's going to move our stock selections in that direction. So, to some degree, our models absolutely are repositioning ourselves. To address some of the other questions, maybe to a broader audience, in terms of taking money off the table, I think you really need a compelling reason to make an asset allocation change. Just because there's a strong upward move in the market, looking at that particular aspect in isolation really is not enough just to take money out of equities, because, you know, the market can move for months. And unless you actually have something to key off of, again, you need to have really a strong reason to do that. And again, particularly in light of the absence of more lucrative alternatives, I mean, equities have been really the place to be. So really, to put it in perspective, allocation moves really need at a minimum to incorporate valuations and return expectations. And from a historical perspective, as I think I mentioned earlier, that, you know, stocks aren't necessarily dirt cheap, but they're relatively cheap from a historical perspective. And in terms of return, that's really where you're going to probably make your money going forward at this point. Thirdly, I think just bringing it down to the client level, you know, if you've got clients that are overly concerned about a market downturn in light of, you know, a run-up like this, I think, again, you need to maybe have a discussion with them to reassess their risk appetite. Because a lot of times, if people are really that concerned about the market declining, they may be, you know, have much more exposure to equities than they really should in the end. John, do you have anything to add?
No. I think that pretty well covers it.
Thank you, Greg. That was good. It doesn't appear that we have any other questions at this time. So once again, thank you for joining our monthly call, and hope to meet you again next month. Thank you.